Daryl Morey, do you want to apologize to me?
I think you've seen from the recent past, I don't do apologies. So.
Daryl Morey is the president of basketball operations for my beloved Philadelphia 76ers, and also, quite possibly, my arch nemesis. Well, let me apologize to you first then, because the real thing that I did to you was prank FaceTime you in like the closing hour or two before the trade deadline of the National Basketball Association while taping Highly Questionable.
What?
He answered!
Oh,
he answered! Hi, Daryl!
No, he just hung up! Damn it!
Damn it!
Just shows the power you have, Pablo, I think. Because I got my new iPhone only for Joel. I hadn't ported all my numbers.
I do want to follow up on why you should apologize to me, though, because it goes back to sort of the reason why I brought you here today, which is to talk about this empire you've built at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. You very specifically went on Dan Le Batard's podcast and just dredged up the fact that you and your people, your army, had kicked me out of the Sloan VIP green room at the Boston Convention Center.
What is the nature of your feud with Pablo Torre?
I think the feud started when he was trying to horn his way into the green room at MIT. And, you know, he was offended that the green room was off limits to him. And I think it went downhill from there, basically. I was trying to figure out how to get back at you when I was on Le Batard. The speaker's room, it's never anything personal. It's just like speakers, and you've been a speaker many times, which we appreciate. But then when you're not a speaker, it's sort of confusing. But we like the visual of you sort of scratching at the window as well.
The Philadelphia 76ers are fogging up the glass of their NBA title window, dominating the NBA's Eastern Conference and preparing for the playoffs, all of which means a lot to new GM Daryl Morey. The face of basketball analytics still has his doubters and his hecklers, including, at times, me. So, fresh off his very exclusive annual convention of nerds and sports, Daryl Morey himself enters the chat to tell me where all of us are going next. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, April 13th. This is ESPN Daily. So me pawing at this sad window like a kitten aside, Daryl, I do want to explain the monster you've created here, because the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference is very well known inside our industry, but it is far less known outside of it. And you and your co-founder, Jessica Gelman, got it going 15 years ago, basically in the spirit of Moneyball, in the spirit of what someone like Bill James did, in exploiting data to find undervalued players and strategies. And every year you bring together researchers and sabermetricians and quants, but now you also get all of these power brokers to somehow agree to be on panels, and I'm talking about owners and athletes and coaches and executives and world leaders like Barack Obama, who was the keynote speaker one year recently. So I'm just curious, first off, what sort of thing is stuck in your mind after you wrapped up the conference last week?
Well, I mean, this year I jumped on the NFT panel. I actually learned a lot because we had the head of NBA Top Shots, the head of So Rare, Mark Cuban, who has more free time than us to focus on this. And I think teams are obviously the NBA is out front at the sports with Top Shot, but I think it's just the start of NBA teams exploiting what crypto can do for them as well. It is very confusing to people, but I think everyone knows what a barcode is. So imagine if you could have put a barcode on literally anything and no one could copy it, and they could always know and look up that it's your thing that's been barcoded. And that's really all it is. You can really NFT anything. The certification has to be digital, but the actual item NFT could be a combination of physical and digital.
What do you think your league does with this?
Well, I think make a lot of money like they have so far.
It has been very good at that at this point, yes.
The NBA has always been pretty good at making money. I'll give Commissioner Stern and Silver credit. So, yeah, I think it's just another way to engage the fans. So the biggest – the sports are going to make it are the ones that can engage, especially the young fans. I think the NBA leads the way, and I think what you can do is pretty unlimited with this stuff.
So we're talking to you ahead of Wednesday. You're playing the Nets. It's a big game on ESPN, all of that. How do you feel at this point in the season, Daryl? It's a weird season. It's the first season back after the bubble, but you guys are tied for first with the Brooklyn Nets. What is your general emotional vibe like as somebody who I imagine is super obsessive and also desperate to win a ring?
I'm desperate to win a ring. That is very true. I would say all year, mostly what Elton Brand and myself have been focusing on is and Doc, all three of us together, has been on how our playoff rotation will look. While in this crazy season where our players are out and the opponents are out, just put enough numbers in the left win column as possible such that you get your path to be as easy as you can. I mean, because the more friction you put in your way in terms of not having home court and stuff, the harder it gets. So all our player moves have been focused on the playoffs. And then during the season, it's about like, how do we manage it through? You know, I think Doc Rivers just been brilliant, honestly. Like every player's playing at a career level, he's been able to manage through with lots of injuries to Joel and Ben and COVID. And I think, you know, we're going to get George Hill back here soon, and we're going to be hopefully on full, knock on wood, full tilt by the time we get to the playoffs. So.
Yeah, I am glad that my call to you before the deadline did not prevent you from acquiring George Hill, because I wanted you guys to get, you know, shooting, some defense, a guy who'd been in big moments, and I'm glad to not have been an obstacle in that quest.
Well, we were going to get George Hill Wednesday, and you really wouldn't have messed it up. We were very far down the line, and it was only because of the quirk of our earlier trade to get Danny Green with Oklahoma City made our trade with Oklahoma City to get George Hill harder because of some of the NBA rules on not reacquiring certain players. So we had to involve a third team, and it took us a while to arrange which third team we could get it done with. Otherwise, that would have been more of a Wednesday type trade, and you would have been fine. You wouldn't have bothered me too much.
You know, Daryl, it's funny. You get profiled so often as like this Galileo character of the NBA. You're the science, the math, the analytics guy whose worldview gets laughed at or attacked as heresy by like people in the old school. But at this point, it also seems pretty clear to me that the world has come around to you. Not only do you have this VIP green room, but the people in power, the people with money, they all agree with you now that data wins, that data is the answer everywhere for good and bad at this point. How have you seen that change?
I think baseball led the way, and obviously Moneyball popularized it. But using data to help make better decisions has been pretty successful in all industries. It's another way of saying, like, you know, using the facts helps you make better decision, right? I mean, you know, a lot of people who were anti-analytics were almost like, they didn't really understand it. Like in basketball, they thought it was just the box score. It was just rebounds and steals and stuff. And they like, that doesn't tell the whole story. And you're right, that doesn't tell the whole story. But when you think about analytics, everyone agrees that scoring more than the other team is good. And those two numbers mean something. Really, analytics is about what are the things that drive those two numbers of how much you score and how much you give up. When you think about it that way, it's really just about using facts to make better decisions.
Have you ever thought about rebranding the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference into the Sloan Sports Information Conference just to get sort of less of a stigma around it?
That's interesting, actually. I think the data conference. I mean, you're right, though. Data sounds like the scary term to some people, too.
Yep, too nerdy, Daryl.
You know, pretty much all sports use data to some or to some extreme extent to help make better decisions, and the ones that don't are slowly changing to use it.
So you often get described also in these conversations as the Billy Bean of the NBA, referencing Moneyball, of course, which was like, for me, for my money, like the best sports book ever written, like the seminal tome. What I did not realize about your story, Daryl, until I started researching it this week, is that Leslie Alexander, the man who hired you with the Houston Rockets, your previous job before running the Sixers, he had actually read Moneyball, and that was sort of helpful in choosing you ultimately?
Well, I think he read Moneyball, and I think he also was like from a Wall Street background and understood that data. And I feel like being an NBA owner is really hard. Really what you want to do is set up a system and process so that you make good decisions consistently over time using data. And I think Leslie was by far the first in the NBA to really, really say, this is the way we have to go, because he had owned the Rockets at that point for about 10 years. And he felt like there had to be a better way. And he searched for quite a while for someone to sort of fit what he wanted. And I got an interview, I think 12 to 18 months into that process, just like as a lark. Like I was so young and unknown at the time. And to give Leslie credit, if you read the original newspaper article when I was hired in 2006 in Houston, he nailed it perfectly. It was just like, if you want to make good decisions, you have to have data, and we're going to have the best data infrastructure in the league. Where I've found the best success is you need an owner who understands the approach of data and how important people are. You need an alignment from that owner to the front office, to the coach, and down to the players. And we had that for many, many years in Houston, obviously with a lot of success, even though not the ultimate success. That's what we have here in Philly with Josh and myself and Doc and down to Joel and Ben and Tobias.
But what I'm really interested in is just the idea of like people play video games, Daryl, now because they want to be a GM. Like they don't do it to control Joel or Ben. They do it to like build franchises, which is just staggeringly different.
So that's a great point. I think like the best way to tell where any sport is going to go is look at their video game. And so 2K is the leading NBA video game and FIFA is the leading soccer game. And in 2K, people barely play the game anymore. They just play the general manager mode. There's some that play the sort of the career mode where you start as like a minor league player. That's sort of a fun tool they built in. But I mean, I don't know what the usage statistics are, but I think it's like 80% of the people just play in GM mode and record it. And what a lot of the data has done is peeled back that there's this role of picking the players and setting the strategy that's potentially as interesting as the players and the coaching and all that. And I think that video games have really peeled back that layer, to your point.
And does that intersect with fantasy sports as well? I mean, it feels like there's billions of dollars in this notion that maybe you're not actually going to be an athlete, a pro athlete, but you could be, and tell me if this is delusional, they could be you.
Well, I think they could. I think, frankly, because I track message boards and things like that, because I think it's where you get some really good ideas, because there's a lot of these really super passionate fans, like you say, who post and post good things, sometimes post nonsense, but a lot of times post really interesting things that keep us on our toes. Probably the best hire I ever made in Houston, who's still in Houston, Eli Whitus. He was a blogger who was writing and coming to the early Sloan conferences. It's sort of a fascinating thing. And when you're in the middle of it, inside of the fishbowl, you're just sort of, it's just the water that we're all part of. I think it's for someone like yourself or others to take a step back and see the larger trends, which is what Michael Lewis did with the original Moneyball.
Okay, Daryl, up next, how and why you want to change the NBA again.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Daryl, when you are now like canvassing the world for new and different ideas, in your brain, I assume you have a vision for change inside of the NBA, rules changes, things you would like to see different and evolved. What does that part of your brain look like right now? What would you like the NBA to resemble?
Yeah, I think about that all the time because as front offices get smarter and smarter, and they have, and to your point, it's accelerated recently, it's going to put a bigger and bigger burden on league offices to be more intentional and structured about their rule changes, because the general direction when you use data is to exploit any inefficiency, just like in Wall Street, it's to look for any generator of value or any distortion created by a government. And so the league offices, like the government, they create these distortions with the rules they pass, and teams are going to exploit those more and more. So leagues have to be more intentional, almost like esports, nerfing and buffing certain characters, or otherwise the game gets boring and a certain path always happens. So in basketball, for me, the big things are on pace of play. If we're talking about on the court stuff, I would use replay less personally. Like I just think if you look at the league data, it's provable that a lot of things are just 50-50 calls, like out of bounds plays where multiple, you know, sort of hands are impacting the ball at one time. I would want to get to a possession arrow. I would get rid of jump balls completely. I would only allow timeouts to be called when the ball is dead, which is a FIBA rule. I would have one free throw for one, two, or three. I would do a whole set of things to get our game to be more free-flowing like soccer is, with less interruptions. And I'd have the Elam ending so that you have a smooth end of a game instead of like a clock-manipulated type situation.
I love how you have 95 theses just to nail on the door of the league office.
Oh, I have more. Daryl. I'm like trying to think of them live here. I have a whole list. Yeah, no. And the good thing about the NBA, they've been the best of the major sports league at fixing the rules. They experiment with the D League fantastically. And, you know, I get frustrated by how slow some of the changes are. But the reality is we change faster than pretty much every other major sport.
So you mentioned nerfing and buffing, these esports terms for like getting rid of characters that have sort of broken the game in some form or another. I feel like some people in the NBA would have nerfed you at a certain point. They would have nerfed your approach to three-pointers, Daryl. How do you feel about the three right now? Because we had Kevin Arnovitz on, and we got the sense via him that you had sort of found a different religion on that.
I've always had the same religion. I mean, the reality is threes need to be nerfed. Like, it's just, they're just way too, like, a shot that's at 8 feet is shot 5% worse only at 25 feet almost, and worth 50% more, just broken. And so it needs to be nerfed. I haven't found new religion, obviously. Look, I mean, in Houston, we built our entire strategy around that. So it wouldn't have been smart for me to focus on that rule change at the time. But the reality that three-pointers are worth too much is pretty well known. There's entire books by Kirk Goldsberry about it. So, and I think the league will come up with ways to fix it over time. We're going to have to, or otherwise, you know, the game will become way too homogenous. To my earlier point, you're just going to have to play a certain way. Every team will look like the Utah Jazz if we don't have a different set of how to play.
Daryl, how much does the number 27 figure into any of your thinking on this stuff now? Because 27 just happens to be the number of consecutive missed three-pointers that your Houston Rockets collected while losing Game 7 of the 2018 Western Conference Finals against the eventual NBA champion Golden State Warriors, with your own trip to the finals on the line.
Oh my goodness, 27 in a row.
For me, it's 25 because by the league's own data, the Warriors fouled us twice in that run. So for me, it's the number 25. I actually don't think about it much. I think about, you know, we had a great team. You know, what I try to do is give the teams I'm working with as great a chance as possible. We have a very good chance again this year, and hopefully we break through.
So full disclosure, I am rooting for you guys. I am via the process, like I am of this religion, it turns out. And I love actually that like deep within your soul, Daryl, is this furnace full of 25 allegedly 25, missed three-pointers, that is clearly propelling you to hopefully a championship parade.
Absolutely. And I would like to acknowledge, you know, Brett Brown and Sam Hinkie, who went through years of struggle so that Doc Rivers, myself, Joel, Ben, and Tobias can now thrive a little bit here. So
as you look toward building the Sixers in the way you see fit, Daryl, you're sort of bridging the philosophies of the process era with the present. I just love the idea of you trolling message boards, trolling subreddits where all these people are giving their 2 cents and just being like, oh yeah, right. I got to get more shooting. Why didn't I think of that? As if that wasn't incredibly obvious already.
Well, that's the thing. When you ask, like, can people do it? Like, look, a lot of times it's just about doing the smart, solid thing. I'll tell a story from my time at the Celtics. When I first got to the Celtics in 2002, I met with, I think it was the, whatever the assistant CFO is, a controller. His name was Tim Rath. And he comes to me and he says, Daryl, I've kept meticulous records. I have every mock draft that was in the Boston Globe for the last 10 years. And if the Celtics had just taken the top player available at every pick, we would have like 6 superstars right now. So, so, you know, look, wisdom of the crowds is real. You got to know when to go with it and when not. And there's data on when to do that. But sometimes it's not about doing the complicated thing. Sometimes it's about doing the solid thing. And it wasn't too hard to figure out that shooting could help Ben and Joel. There was a lot of data to show that. Obviously, finding the deals to make that happen takes usually like just searching for 100 deals, and then only one of those 100 happen. You know, it's funny. It's like, we need shooting. Who's the second highest percentage shooter of all time? Oh, Seth Curry. Oh, maybe he'll be good. Like, I mean, there's more to it than that, but sometimes there isn't.
Can we command F Curry? That felt like what you did there, basically. And you're like, oh yeah, huh?
There's two of them. So good.
The true market inefficiency is that Del Curry had 2 sons. So, Daryl, I feel like I've buttered you up enough here. So the real question I have to just wrap up, I know the green room at Sloan is a real, you know, touchy, dicey velvet rope to get behind, but I'm hoping that as the priest of the process, you might have room for me on, you know, a float at some point.
Well, I think what we'll have to do is make sure we have you as a speaker. Because you're a heck of a moderator and a panelist. So I think that'll be the solve.
Daryl, I like how you managed to both compliment me and give me more work to do, which honestly feels about right.
Sounds good. I appreciate you having me on today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. All right, coming up, Myron Metcalf tells us about the scene in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota, on a heartbreakingly familiar day.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Yesterday, the sports world stopped once again to consider what is happening in the state of Minnesota after an unarmed black man was killed Sunday on video by police once again. 20-year-old Dante Wright had been driving through Brooklyn Center, a Minneapolis suburb, when cops pulled him over for a traffic stop that escalated into a brief struggle, one that ended with one of the officers firing her gun and plunging the Twin Cities region into just the latest wave of protests and local unrest. Because less than 10 miles away from where Wright died is the courtroom, which happens to be hosting the ongoing trial of the former Minneapolis cop who's been charged with the murder of George Floyd. And amid all this chaos, and with a curfew now imposed on the area, the Minnesota Twins postponed last night's home game against the Red Sox, and then the Timberwolves postponed their home game against the Nets, and then the Wild postponed their home game against the Blues. And then Sixers coach Doc Rivers said this before Philly's game against the Mavs.
You keep hearing this cancel culture stuff, but we're canceling Black lives. And I think, to me, that's a little, more important, in my opinion. And it just keeps happening. We keep making mistakes on killing Black people.
So early last night, we called up our friend and colleague in Minnesota, Myron Metcalf, to check in. Myron, I know you live in the Twin Cities. You live around St. Paul. How would you describe what the area feels like right now?
I would just say the whole city feels tense, emotional, pain, I think is probably the most pressing word. I think everybody, if you live in this area in the Twin Cities, that you sort of carried this weight over the last year after what happened to George Floyd. And then there was sort of this anticipation of the trial for Derek Chauvin and all the emotions you knew that would demand. So for something like this to happen with the young man, Dante Wright, to lose his life on Sunday and another officer involved shooting and killing, it's just shocking. And it's just really hard to process all of it, honestly.
Yeah. What did you end up doing today, Myron? Where did you go? What did you see?
I drove out to where Dante Wright lost his life on Sunday. I just felt compelled to go out there and just to see it and to be there. And then I drove to the place where a lot of protests have been happening in front of the precinct, in front of a place called Brooklyn Center, which is just outside Minneapolis, just north of Minneapolis. And I just kind of sat there with everybody as they were grieving, as they were expressing their anger, and just trying to digest something that feels like it's just too heavy of a burden for any of us to carry. And it was an emotional scene, and it was something that feels unfair to this community that's already trying to wrap its head around what's happening with Derek Chauvin and what happened to George Floyd, and then something like this happens, it's really difficult to describe.
Yeah, it's remarkable, Myron. It is staggeringly sad and remarkable how often we look outside of Minnesota to where you are, because you mentioned the most recent tragedy. And you go back further than that, right? You go back further, in fact, than Dante Wright. You go to Philando Castile in 2016. And it just feels like from the outside, there is this news cycle, this loop that just doesn't end. And I wonder how you even begin to process that when you're in the city itself.
You know, I've just been talking to a lot of people I know in this community, and I think we've all shared, especially those who are Black, just a sense of not feeling safe, wondering how this continues to happen in a place that's not very big. I mean, the state isn't gigantic in terms of population, and the Twin Cities isn't this massive place, and it's happening, and you're wondering why it's happening and what that says about this entire place. And you just can't really escape the heaviness. And I think what happened with George Floyd is there was a sense of, we know this can happen because it's happened multiple times here, but you almost felt like the trial with Derek Chauvin was going to bring some closure almost. And what happened on Sunday with Dante Wright makes you realize that this wound is never going to close and that you probably will never heal. And you just have to learn to somehow power through this, which, again, that feels unfair that we're being asked to do that.
Yeah. And we're watching right now sports in Minnesota, in Minneapolis in specific, We're watching everyone basically postpone games. Major League Baseball with the Twins, the NBA with the Timberwolves, the NHL with the Minnesota Wild. All those games that were scheduled to be played on Monday night are now going to be postponed. What does that signify to you as part of this entire cycle playing out?
We've been here before. I mean, while the rest of the world was reacting to what happened with George Floyd, the Twins and the Wild and the Vikings and the Timberwolves and the Lynx, they were all dealing with this at the doorstep. So I think a lot of it is just sort of an unfair, just a really raw familiarity with what has happened in the past.
The pro athletes in the city, Myron, you only need to go back to last year to see how engaged and outspoken many of them were on issues specifically like this. What do you expect to see and hear from them in the days to come?
I expect them to be very vocal once games return. You know, when George Floyd was killed, you saw Karl Anthony Towns out leading marches, participating. You saw the Minnesota Lynx. You saw members of all of the different sports teams locally expressing themselves. And it was more than just a tweet. They were on the street. They were in the middle of these demonstrations and protests. And I think you'll see that again going forward. This has been a place where athletes can't get away with a no comment in moments like this. So I expect the Karl Anthony Towns and the Byron Buxtons and the Minnesota Lynx and all these other athletes to actually take a stance like they have so many times in the past here.
So I want to note here, Myron, you're not just our college basketball correspondent here at ESPN. You're also a columnist for the Star Tribune, the big paper in Minneapolis, in the Twin Cities. What would you want people to know out in America, out in the world, about what it's like right now where you are, and what it's like in specific as a Black person trying to live a safe, happy, healthy life, as you put it on Twitter, but obviously finding obstacles repeatedly in this context along the way?
Well, the Star Tribune called me after George Floyd died, and they wanted to diversify their coverage and offer someone like me a perspective to talk about what it's like to be a Black man in this place. And it's sad that this is all happening again, but I would say that, and I think a lot of people I know who are Black feel this exact thing. I think it's a sense of our happiness is never going to be permanent. And that feels dark and that feels really negative, but it's also quite honest because it was so hard to feel anything permanently after Philando, which Philando died a few miles from where I had my first apartment in the city. And then other incidents happen. And then you get to George Floyd. And it's just so hard. Whatever happiness you had built up to that moment about being in Minnesota and progress that was being made, you lost it again. And now here comes what happened to Dante Wright. It feels like every day you are tearing down, rebuilding and recovering and going through that process over and over again when you're Black in Minnesota. And it's just not right. And it's heavy. And I wish it wasn't that. I wish that wasn't the emotion, but I don't know any other emotion that describes how so many of us are feeling right now.
Myron Metcalf, thank you for sharing how you're feeling on an incredibly difficult day.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.